From Boca Raton, Florida, this is Behind the Bima. On this episode, the rabbis are joined by Allison Josephs, founder and executive director of Jew in the City. Allison discusses what we can do about anti-Semitism, shares her strategy for showing the world the beauty of Judaism, and explains how we can step up and stand out as Jews. Also, helping college students learn and explore their Judaism, and recapping a special program at BRS on addiction and recovery. All this and more Behind the Bima.
Good evening. It is Wednesday night, 9 p.m. I'm Rabbi Ephraim Gold. We're joined by my colleague and dear friend, Rabbi Josh Brody, and we are here to take you
Behind the Bima.
Behind the Bima. How come when I say good evening, I sound like the Count?
Good evening.
Good evening. Who was that? The Count?
Frankenstein.
It is a good evening because we are together and we are together with you. It's a good evening because here we are. And because there's so much blessing and bracha in our lives, so much to be grateful for. We start with our attitude of gratitude and our gratefulness to Rachel and Dan Rudensky, our beloved members, in memory of Michael Brenzel sponsoring this episode. Rachel and Dan, thank you for all that you do, for this generosity, for your leadership and your love, the Jewish community, our community, and so much more. And we appreciate your support and your friendship. Rabbi Broday.
Wow, what a week. First of all, I was in Baltimore on Sunday. Monday, Richmond.
Baltimore.
I started out my day. Well, there was a lot of excitement going on in Baltimore, but it started out. I went to Neir Yisrael, got to daven with my Rebbe, with Rabbi Frand. And then afterwards, Rabbi Gibber's son said, hey, do you want to go? First, I said, Rabbi Frand said, you know, go see the new dining room. There's a beautiful new dining room. I loved it. He says, I said, can I take a coffee? He says, you put it on my tab. So I go get a coffee. And then Rabbi Gibber's son says, do you want to go see the Rosh Hashiva? So he just goes, knocks on the door. Got to meet with the Rosh Hashiva, got a bracha.
Amazing. It's great.
Yeah, so it's just an exciting way to start the week.
One of the proud alumni of Neir Yisrael.
I'm going to make them so proud. They have no idea what's about to come.
Do they know that you're learning more than ever now?
No, I didn't get into that. I was telling them about this other project.
You are a machine.
First of all, I scored an 83%, my highest score ever on the Rashi Bechinas.
Beautiful.
I've never got that high. We're at 84.
I love that you're taking that. I love that you're doing
that. Yeah, but last week I got like a 60, so I'm trying.
Let's give a little follow-up to some previous conversations and episodes. First of all, our episode with Rav Berkowitz, the Rosh Hashiva of Aish from a couple weeks ago, that was recorded at Aish. In his office. His office, though, you know, Aish is a stone building. The office is like a cave. The windows were open. It was a Monday. All the bar mitzvahs being celebrated at the Kotel. The sounds were pouring in, and the sound quality was terrible. And it breaks my heart because Rav Berkowitz is amazing, and the conversation was incredible. And there's so much richness there. So we worked on the audio and the sound. Our team of engineers, thank you, Matthew Miller, Yam Michelle. We worked on our sound and reposted it. So if you haven't listened yet, give it another shot. Rav Berkowitz, well worth listening to. Also, I mentioned last week I was in Auburn for a day, and the incredible delegation, Auburn Tigers, by the way, now 3-0. Coach Bruce Pearl, we gave him an award, and his team supporting Israel, loving Israel. I whispered at half court right before tip-off, the opening of the season, 15th ranked team in the country. I said to him, he's such a good guy. I said, those who bless Israel are blessed. Coach, you got this, no problem. And he had been nervous all day about the game. He's worried. You know, he said to me, as a representative of doing all of this, posting, advocating, standing for the Jewish people for Israel, he's not only have to win games because Auburn's counting on him and the university and the team and the town and the players and the fans, but now, you know, you put yourself out there. If you don't win, someone says, hey, what are you spending all this time on Twitter focusing on anti-Semitism in Israel? So I said to him, those who bless Israel are blessed. Those who bless the Jewish people are blessed. Your team is blessed, Israel and the Jewish people. Don't worry, you got this. Just saying they're 3-0. So other teams might want to consider their attitude towards the Jewish people and Israel. They want to go. It's a new skula if you want to go on a win streak. Anyway, but I mentioned while I was there, Auburn, 30,000 students in Auburn. There's about 30 Jewish students. And I met with the Hill. I met with a bunch of these students. And it's unbelievable. I met with a group of the students from Alabama. It's a state school. Wonderful, wonderful young people who really have no, I was going to say background, but the Lubavitcher Rebbe was very opposed to a Jew saying that someone has no background. You know, the Lubavitcher Rebbe said,
Kirov. He didn't like the word Kirov.
He didn't like the word Kirov either, but he didn't like the word background. You know why? He'd say, you're not a child of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. You don't descend from Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. Every Jew has a background. Every Jew has the most beautiful, most glorious background. Every Jew has the best background. Maybe you don't have an education, but you have a background. Anyway, so I met with a few students from Alabama who really had no education, nothing, and had a great schmooze, great connection, couple hours, spent some time, hoped you made a difference. Nothing, no one else. There's no Chabad yet at, I'm going to work on that, at Auburn. And there's a Hillel, but basically one of the faculty is like part-time to run a Hillel, which is like a few social events, but there's no religious component, learning, studying Jewish growth. And again, it's not a criticism of anyone. It's very few Jewish students at this university. Here's why I'm telling you this story, Rabbi Joshua Brody.
Let's do this.
I'm telling you this story because every student I met with got in touch with me after I left and said, I want to know more about my Judaism. I want to learn more. Now, each of them said, can you recommend a book or a podcast or a website? What can I read? I said, I'll do you one better. And I went to some members in our community. I challenged them. I said, I've got these students. And you know what? I don't know the trajectory of their life. I don't know their path. One of them is actually graduating in December, in January. Others are earlier on in Auburn. I said, they could be a statistic. With a 70% intermarriage rate in America outside of Orthodoxy, they could easily be a statistic. You have an hour a week to spend on the phone, on FaceTime, on Zoom with them. And Ilan and Evan are now learning, members of our community, learning with a couple Auburn students. And it's going to change their lives. But here's the thing, by the way, right? It's a chesed, it's a kindness. It's nice that they're learning with these students, give them a little more knowledge, a little more exposure, help enrich their life with their Judaism. But you know who's going to benefit the most? Not the students. These members of our community, you know, who are going to take an hour and think about, what am I going to talk about? How do I verbalize and articulate and communicate it? Why is it beautiful? How do I get these students to come to Boca for a Shabbos? Maybe we can convince them to spend some time in Israel.
Bring their family.
Yeah, the time that they're going to put in and dedicate to these students, they're going to be enriched. So I don't know, it's very gratifying to me. Frankly, you know, there were moments I wasn't exactly sure why I was in Auburn, as much as was grateful
was to reason. Be able
to, grateful to award and recognize Coach Pearl, Mordechai Pearl, Bruce Pearl, and the Auburn Tigers. But, you know, these students, and I'm so grateful to our members who answered the call. And that is a small example of a program that's about to come out, Boca Raton Synagogue. We don't talk about it now, but it's going to be unbelievable. There will not be any room in the, no chairs, no seats left in the room with the number of people who are going to be learning with those who don't have that educational background.
Someone asked me, they said, you know, with this program, how many people do you want to get? Like, what's your goal? I said, what do you mean? They said, you want a number? They said, yeah, there's 165,000 people. I mean, is that a good number?
Right.
Can we just go with everyone?
Yeah, let's go.
Yeah,
let's get every Jew, every Jew in Palm Beach
County. Partner them up. Partner them up.
Unbelievable. Every Jew sitting opposite another Jew. And you know, for those listening or watching and who think, it's not for me, I don't really know enough, I'm not a rabbi, I'm not a rebbetzin, I'm not trained, I don't have the knowledge. You just have to know a little more than the other person. And when someone knows nothing, that's not hard. And you just have to speak from the heart and share what it is to, for you. And everyone can get involved. So that's really great. So that's sort of Berkowitz follow-up, little Auburn follow-up. Rabbi Birdie's still sticking with the daf. Let's get a little
still
follow-up.
Sticking with the daf. You know, I guess, was it today or yesterday? Emor Ma'at V'yaseh Harbe, right? Using Avram Avinu as the great person. He says, I'll just give you some pita bread, and he ends up giving tongues and everything. Right. And as opposed to, right, what happens when he goes to negotiate now for the burial plot, right? The Rashaim, what do they do? What do? They say a lot, and they give you nothing. They give you gornished. So the daf is rocking. We got the daf.
Got the daf rocking last week.
Shnai Mikra.
Last week I was at an amazing event, Art Scroll. Art Scroll made a Siyum on Yerushalmi, a dream of Rav Meir Zlotowitz of blessed memory. Took 18 or 19 years to complete, and this was the culmination. And think of what Art Scroll, Talmud Shas, Bavli did for the world. What's amazing is that you walk into Bubba Vishnitz, Gare, you walk into Yeshiva University, you walk into YCT, you probably walk in, I'm going to guess, JTS. You walk in to any institute for Torah learning from any segment of the Jewish world, certainly any segment of the Orthodox world, and there's that same set of R. Scroll Gemara, Schottenstein Gemara. Think about what it did for the world. It brought the world together in the sense that obviously Shas, the Talmud, the Gemara is the text that we're all talking about. We're on the same page, but it opened it up. It made it available and accessible. And what they did for Bavli, now they've done for Yerushalmi, the Talmud Yerushalmi, which has been considered a closed book for 1600 years. And they translated it into English, into Hebrew. We have three daily dafyomis in our shul, BRS, three daily dafyomis in Bavli. But as of this past Monday, we got a daily dafyomi in Yerushalmi. Thanks to the new cycle, thanks to Art Scroll. And it was an event. The event was held last week. First of all, it was held the day a hurricane was supposed to come. Yecheva was like, why are we driving down? They're canceling. There's no way. Should we be leaving our children? What's going to be? 800 Jews were there. They found a way there.
That somehow was a, hurricane. That hurricane hit Miami. Hurricane of Jews.
Hurricane of Jews. Yerushalmi. Amazing event. Ran into a bunch of previous guests behind the Bima, including, well, I don't have to go through the list, but a bunch of behind the Bima guests previously, and also lined up a bunch of future guests. Some really great people, great leaders. Very excited. We'll be coming on to have conversations. The event was the night of Kristallnacht commemoration, night on the calendar of Kristallnacht. And Jay Schottenstein spoke. Schottenstein family, what they've meant, his father Jerome, now Jay and his family, what they're doing. And Jay Schottenstein spoke, and he said, you know, his mother-in-law, who's still alive, grew up in Germany, and she remembers Kristallnacht. She lived opposite a shul. She remembers looking out her window and watching the shul, the glass be broken, the shul be burned and destroyed. And she remembers they're burning all the Sfarim, all the books. And he said, here we are, the Schottenstein edition of the Talmud Yerushalmi. Our answer to the burning of books is to translate and to share more and to spread more books, to publish more books. And what a response, what an answer. And, you know, it was like a goosebump moment. It was a really great night. So mazel tov to Art Scroll, to the Schottensteins, to the Zlotowitzes, to all the people who do that great, great work. It was a really beautiful, beautiful evening.
And if anyone wants a free Gemara right now, Art Scroll Gemara, just go to merkazdafyomi.com and you'll get a free Gemara.
Merkazdafyomi. There's a lot more to talk about. We got a special guest, Allison Josephs, who has been a visitor to our community. Her parents actually live in Boca, not our shul, but in Boca. She didn't grow up here. Who's got a great story of her own journey to become a balas tshuva. She did not grow up and wasn't rich. She had a background, but she did not grow up observant. And not only is she observant of Torah, but now dedicating her life to bring others closer, a founder, executive director of Jew in the City, which has three branches, three efforts that it's making. It's become really, since we first met and we hosted her, it's become really sophisticated in what it's doing and trying to do and trying to share with the world. Really exciting to bring her on. We don't have time now, but we'll unpack another time. And maybe we'll invite the Rebbetzins on for this conversation. But there was an article in Mishpacha magazine a couple of weeks ago that tried to show two sides of a story. Right. So they tried to show two sides of the story about, you know, is the Rebbetzin obligated to go to everything in the community? And there's the one argument that you're the Rebbetzin, you're our only Rebbetzin, the presence means so much, you might got to make the effort, you got to show up. And there's the other side, that the Rebbetzin is not under contract, she's not paid for what she does, she'll do her best, but sometimes it's hard to manage it all. And okay, the article showed two sides of a story, reasonable, respectable, understandable, with some harsh letters that came in. One really strong, basically telling Rebbetzins, step up, show up, man up, or woman up, and really, I think, very out of place, very, very disrespectful in some ways, offensive and unappreciative of what Rebbetzins do, and some letters back and forth. I think it's an interesting conversation about sort of the role. Is the Rebbetzin just the rabbi's wife? Does she have an independent identity as Rebbetzin? Should she be compensated for it? What should the expectations be of it? It's a great conversation, not for now, but tonight's not about a Rebbetzin. It's about another female leader of our Jewish community, Allison Josephs, and the wonderful shoe work she does. And we're super excited to be able to welcome her this evening and to go behind the Bima with her. Hello, Allison. It's great to be together again. Great to see you. Thank you so much for agreeing and joining us behind the Bima to talk about all the incredible work that you're doing. And there is so much that we certainly won't have enough time, but at least we can get started with this. So thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. So glad to be here.
So I know you're working under the banner of Jew in the City. There are so many branches and so many directions that you're going in. And for our listeners, many or most of whom are aware, but to remind them, there's the Keter. We're most familiar with your work, promoting the beauty of Torah and Orthodox all-stars and letting the world know just how rich and beautiful and meaning and relevant our Torah is for Jews and for the world. Makom, which we're becoming more familiar with recently, we'll get into that one big article recently, but addressing a community of people who grew up Orthodox and are struggling to stay Orthodox, maybe some bad messages or messaging they've gotten off the derech, struggling to be functionally within it, and then tikkun, to work on, and I really admire this, behind the scenes, what are the problems, what are the challenges, how are we misrepresenting what our Torah should be? Where are we broken in our systems, and how can we, behind the scenes, how can we create create an agenda and be working on those things? So three separate areas, they're amazing. My opening question to you is, which one is the most compelling right now, right at this time? When you sit down every day and you're like, I have so many hours to give, is it going into Keter, Makom, or Tikkun? What does the world need to be repaired most in right now, today, in the hierarchy, in the priority? How do you list them?
So So I think because anti-Semitism is on the rise, that's sort of feeling the most acute. And, you know, if we're not feeling happy being Jewish, but like, you know, anti-Semites are chasing us, like maybe we have to sort of deal with that later as we're running, but sort of that sense of danger and despair. And look, I was raised eating bacon cheeseburgers. And at the same time, my mother told us, like from the youngest age, things are good today and things were good in the past. And every country eventually tires of its Jews. And one day things could change here. So that's sort of like a message that was given over in my mother's milk of, you know, Jews are not safe in exile. And so I think in a way, Kanye West sort of did a favor to us that he brought anti-Semitism more to the fore, more to conversations. Celebrities that had not talked about anti-Semitism as Jews were being literally hacked with machetes, shot, you know, gunned down in shuls. They're actually talking about it now. So the work that we're doing at Ketzer with our new Hollywood Bureau, in a lot of ways, I feel like we can have the biggest impact. And if I can just give listeners a brief overview.
Sure.
In the last number of years, we've always approached changing the perception of Orthodox Jews via social media. I got onto YouTube probably 16, 17 years ago. For a while, I was a one-woman show, not making any money. Literally everyone around me was like, this is not going anywhere. Like, get a real job, Allison. And then social media grew and, you know, sort of our reach grew. But there's still a limit. There's still a limit when we have, you know, large platforms like NBC putting out episodes of nurses with Hasidic Jews that refuse non-Jewish organ donations, completely against Jewish law. When we have, you know, Netflix just obsessed with the story of Jews leaving. And at the same time, every other minority group seemingly more proud of their heritage, leaning in harder, you know, being more out about who they are, and somehow Jews being in a different category. And with unorthodox and my unorthodox life coming out in such close succession to one another, I was being interviewed by reporters and they were getting confused about which show we were talking about because there were so many unorthodox. And it was like, what the heck is going on? About a year and a half ago, a reporter mentioned to me in passing, Muslim PAC Hollywood Bureau. I get online and I'm like astounded. I see the Muslim community has organized themselves to have a presence with every studio and network where they're advocating to be in the room to give whole and human depictions of the Muslim experience. And I'm thinking, wait, I thought Jews control Hollywood. What do the Muslims know that we don't know? I'm like both like awed and also like a little bit jealous. Like, how do they do this? I go onto Instagram to tell our fans, someone should start this for the Jews. Someone's got to start this. I try to tag MPAC Hollywood Bureau. I accidentally tag NAACP Hollywood Bureau. I'm like, wait, the Black community has this too? I go to Google. I search Asian Hollywood Bureau. I see CAPE, C-A-P-E. At that point, I realized all these bureaus have four letters and we're J-I-T-C. Once I knew that everyone was doing this, that made me feel a lot less afraid because it's like if everyone's doing this and no one did it for us, people maybe are just scared to. And like, that's something I don't have a problem with, just sort of getting up, going out and like being the starter of things. And my philosophy has always been, we'll figure it out as we go. So we basically started meeting the bureaus. From there, we started meeting the networks. And about a year before this all happened, we had gotten the social media storm started around this nurses episode with this awful, you know, organ donation scene. And my line is that we went from tweeting to meeting with NBC in less than a year, which was super exciting.
That is amazing. And that's a huge difference. There's so many fronts that we're fighting this anti-Semitism battle on. And there's a lot of questions around it. I wrote an article this week listing the questions, not even trying to provide the answers about how we define anti-Semitism. Do we go to the nuclear option of cancel rather than engage and turn around and educate? Who should make these decisions? Should we be debating online? I'm sure you saw after Chappelle's Saturday Night Live intro this week, you see, Twitter is alive with Jews debating among ourselves. Was he hilarious? Is it in good fun? Is it horrific and the worst thing you ever saw? And I just wonder whether that's the right platform or venue for us to be having this debate while an audience of anti-Semites are learning from us and watching us and going to quote from us. So there's so many questions, but one thing that we know for sure is not a question is there is a spike. We got to be doing things. And that is a wonderful thing that you're doing and so important because millions of eyeballs learn about Judaism and their entire image of a Jew is from what they see in that arena. And it should at least be accurate and even occasionally, hopefully positive as well. So that's really fantastic work. So that's your priority right now is on the anti-Semitism focus. So continue after that. What comes next for you? Are you more worried about sort of Orthodox Jews staying Orthodox and seeing the beauty of it and not being turned off or turned away through dysfunction? Are you more dedicated or devoted, more concerned about non-Orthodox, seeing Orthodoxy as beautiful? What's your next direction or target audience?
So I would say, you know, Bakum comes next in that the work that we've done through Ketzer has always been a little bit impersonal because, yes, there are people that write in or comment, but there's still sort of that screen separating. There's sort of the bigger vision of changing perceptions and taking control of our characters and depictions, but it's not personal. Over at Mockum, we have hundreds of members with like deeply tragic and painful stories. And so there is a piece of that that while it's on a smaller scale, it's so much more personal. You know, we have members over to our house. We have, you know, Shabbatons, you know, very active WhatsApp groups and different events. And so while it's sort of making an impact on a smaller scale, we're doing it on a deeper scale. And so, you know, I devote a good amount of my time also being engaged in these WhatsApp groups and answering questions. And what we've seen, and there's an article or a couple of articles you referred to that I wrote recently in Mishpacha, we've seen some really significant patterns in sort of the OTD phenomenon, the leaving observance phenomenon, that I think is really meaningful for anybody that wants to try to understand their feelings of feeling displaced, of feeling so angry at God or at Judaism. How do you begin to break that apart? You know, what Netflix will tell you is that Jews are all bad and, you know, evil. And the only way to be sort of a self-actualized Jew is to escape that awful community. What we're seeing actually, and what we sort of learned from Mockum from beginning, is that it's not really about more ultra or more modern. That's not actually the conversation. It's really about dysfunction and abuse. And what I've learned over the years working with hundreds of members in the last 7 years since we launched Mockum is that it is very hard to look at the patterns in one's childhood. And, you know, things like not feeling seen, held, heard, unconditionally loved, not feeling like you could ever quite exhale in your home. You could be raised by parents who are loving, who have tried their best to raise you in a positive way with all their effort. But because of dysfunction that they were raised with, because of dysfunction their parents were raised with, in many cases, because of the Holocaust. And what Mako members taught me actually is that the Hasidic community is nearly 100% survivors or descendants of survivors, basically in a closed system, very little interaction with the larger world. So when there's, you know, so much pain and trauma, due to, by the way, anti-Semitism. So kind of that brings back that piece in there again, creating intergenerational trauma. We can either say, well, Judaism is all garbage and we should just free ourselves of that. And the early creators of Hollywood who started Hollywood basically had that message. What we're trying to do instead is untangle the dysfunction and the abuse from the beauty of Torah itself. And so that's really meaningful work because it's close-up work, it's personal work, and we're seeing the most courageous people who are sort of ready to do that, lean in, look at the patterns of how Torah was given over, or even how lack of love or lack of being seen or heard was given over, and separating the two out. That, of course, then helps us tell a story more effectively through Ketzer. And that also helps us approach leadership and other organizations on the Tikkun side to be able to say, there are some serious patterns that we're seeing here. And the goal should really be for Judaism to be a pleasant and peaceful thing. That's really, it should uplift our lives. It should allow room for self. This is my thesis of what people want. People want a meaningful life and an enjoyable life. And right now, many people, Jews included, religious Jews included, don't believe that Torah offers meaning and offers physical pleasure and enjoyment and self-actualization. And that's really what we have to correct. Torah not only can, it should, when it's practiced in a healthy way. And so there's a lot of re-educating outside to the people that, you know, it's almost triage with the Mako members. And then Tikkun is almost going to the battlefront because there's only so much triage you can do. There's only so much like bailing water out of a ship that you can do. The idea of having to, you know, close up the hole or go to the battlefront where, you know, the hurt is happening. It's obviously a lot to take on and people probably think I'm crazy when I describe it, but again, it's sort of this idea of like, we have to get started somewhere. And, you know, the success that we have is due to our incredible team, our board, our donors, and, you know, obviously a lot of Siyata Dishmaya.
So I have a million follow-up questions, but okay. I want to actually take a break a moment from this work of which I have a million questions and ask you something personal. So you're a public personality. You put yourself out there from day one, as you spoke about, on a YouTube platform. And the movement at first was you. You were the face of it, are the face of it. You're a public person. And being a public person means that you invite, you welcome, and you have to ultimately you have to deal with criticism, social media, emails, and life. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the Big Mishpacha article that you recently wrote might be a major foray into a different segment of the community through Mishpacha, a different audience, and it's garnered a lot of attention. Many, many follow-up editions of Mishpacha continuing to still print the letters and this conversation, because you shared that thesis about Makom. You shared that thesis about a common denominator of many of the people off the derech has to do with their upbringing and maybe not having warmth, love, affection, approval that they needed. And you saw that manifest itself among the Makom members you interact with. And the reaction, many letter writers wrote in, thank you, you give me a voice. That's exactly my story. That is exactly why I feel this way. Others, particularly parents, some have been like, how dare you? How do you know why it happened? And how can you diagnose it? And how can you speak for everyone? You didn't do a major data study, but experts. And it's been a mixed reaction. And before we get into that question and the article, I just have a question for you. What's it like for you to open the Mishpacha each week and read those letters, right? I went through that similarly on an article I had written in that thesis. And how does that affect you? When you read these letters, have you dug in to say, I still stand by the original article and it's an interesting take the others have, but they're wrong? Do you read some of the letters and say, you know, going back, I wish maybe I could have worded some things a little bit differently, or maybe expanded the thesis a little bit? Has this been hard for you, for your family? As I said, you've been online, you know, anyone who's a public person online endures the trolls online. But Mishpacha is another segment of the community. Has it been different for you to navigate reaction and response in that venue than it has been until now in more of the online world?
So it's so interesting because I'll like meet people or potential donors and like, can I be frank with you? Like, are you okay? And I'm like, I live on social media. Like, I have built up the thickness of skin that you couldn't imagine at this point. I think a lot of times when people have very strong reactions, it has to do with something that they're going through, their own personal trigger, than anything that I'm doing. That's not to say that I'm above reproach. I have, you know, a range of people that I go to for feedback, and, you know, I'm open to, you know, honest feedback. I want to obviously always be working on myself and growing. I'll tell you a little lesson that I learned years ago when I got a particularly nasty message that was really based on nothing. Just, I don't know, just someone writing in and writing a nasty comment to me. Moshe Rabbeinu had haters. Moshe Rabbeinu was literally appointed by Hashem, and he had haters. Now, Korach was jealous, and I think a lot of times people that dislike leaders, it's due to jealousy or, you know, some sort of, you know, thing they're working through. But when I realized that Moshe Rabbeinu was appointed by God, which I'm not, and had haters, I realized that with leadership comes dissent, and there's going to be no way to be a leader without sort of recognizing that that's part of the package. So what it means is that for the people that I respect, and that's a wide range of people, I will go to for feedback. I will have conversations, you know, this way, that way, you know, sometimes change the message mid-course, you know, social media and online content allows editing to occur, and just, you know, continue conversations. Not everybody is worth listening to. There are some people that are deeply unhealthy or self-interested that are not worth listening to. So I don't have to please everyone. I won't please everyone. I gave a caveat, you know, that I haven't met everyone. I stand by the message. The interesting thing is that, like, my community doesn't really read Mishpacha. So, like, whatever is happening in printed pages in a magazine that, like, we're not reading or most people I know aren't reading, like, doesn't really have an effect on me. Also, you know, there's nothing that Mishpacha would print that would be worse than, like, what trolls on the internet would say. They, you know, they printed articles that were, you know, comments that, you know, weren't nasty, weren't ad hominem. I understand the reaction of parents that don't want to go there. What I really would say to anyone that responds, and just to give over the basic thing, these things of being seen, held, heard, are called by therapist Jasmine Lee Corey good mother messages. And I showed how we can find these good mother messages. I see you. I delight in you. I respect in me. You can rest in me. I found these messages throughout Jewish sources. Their rabbinic advisor was totally cool with everything that, you know, I wrote, which I thought was really neat. And I understand for a parent to see this and feel like it's an attack, which it's not. It's really a form of education. I heard from so many parents that recognize these holes in their own attachment style and now want to do preventative work, recognize that they have these attachment wounds and now want to heal the relationship with their children. Heard from people struggling right now who have not gone OTD yet that recognize these wounds and are now finding a vehicle for repair. So, okay, it's a triggering topic. I knew it would be, but I reached out to Mishpacha to publish this because we've been doing this type of work specifically for about a year and a half. And we've seen so much growth for the people that are ready to take this honest look that I actually felt an achrayus to say, this is what we've seen, this is what we've learned. If there's someone out there that's struggling, either a parent wondering what they did wrong, or a spouse wondering like what happened to my husband or wife, or a person who's willing, you know, to look honestly and say, why do I feel this way? I wanted to share what we've learned. But I knew that it would come with, you know, some negative feedback. And I told the Mako members, I got into fights with other people's parents, essentially, because a lot of times people aren't able to say these things to their parents. They are too scared to tell their parents what they're actually feeling. And I wanted the information to be out there for anyone that was willing to dig in. And my response to anyone who's upset is, do these messages make you triggered? Ask your child if they trigger them at all. If they say no, then I guess I'm wrong for that case. But so far, this test has worked for really anyone that I've presented it to.
So I have a few follow-up questions about Project Makom. First of all, what is the typical like age bracket of the member who comes to you from Project Makom? How do you find them? How do they find you? What's your staff like? I mean, I assume you have therapists who are working with them. I don't know if you have support groups. Like, what exactly day-to-day is Makom offering? And what is the typical like graduate of Makom? Like, where are they headed when they finish with your program? So those just a little bit of information.
Yeah.
About
it. Hold on, Yocheved, unpack the last part of your question.
No, I'm just curious, what would be a success story? Like, where do you expect them to go? Where do you want, what's the goal? Where do you send them?
Meaning, is your goal that they stay in, let's say, if they come from a Hasidic community, they stay there, versus you gave them entrance into other parts of Torah communities that maybe speak more to them?
Yeah.
Is that your question?
Yeah.
So, okay, so just to clarify, we rebranded a year ago because we were basically at a point when Makom was started where it was Project Makom and Jew in the City. And people were coming up to me and they were like, are you connected to Project Makom? I'm like, yeah, I founded it. So we did a rebranding where we dropped the project and then we gave the names Keter, Makom, Tikkun. So just to clarify that sometimes people do say project still, but that is sort of part of our old branding. In terms of what we offer, Makom started because an ex-Ultra Hasidish couple came to a Kiruv talk I was giving in Rockland Community College in 2014. I had seen footsteps. I had seen those stories in the news. Media loves to amplify the stories of the bad Orthodox Jews and the brave people who escaped. But honestly, like, I didn't really have any connection to that. And it was really just to say that's not all of us. Those are some kind of crazy extreme cases. Not all of us. This couple had been following Jew in the City. That was super surprising. I had made this content for people like me. If non-Jews would see it too and have a positive reaction, fine. But like, I'd had no idea that from people and ex-from people would find this to be meaningful, or even frankly, that I had something to teach people that were raised religious. I sort of had a little bit of a bals tshuva idea that like I could explain to people like me with less of a background, but not someone that's raised in it. What I've learned is that being a person that had to figure these things out from my own personal journey is very meaningful to people that are sometimes doing this by rote and being spoon-fed. So as we found in Makom, what we found was that a lot of people that had gone to footsteps that had left completely had actually tried to stay religious first. They had actually wanted to join another community but didn't feel welcomed in our circles because people didn't quite know how to look for them or sort of how to sort of absorb them in terms of culture, in terms of getting them up to speed with the kids, in terms of secular studies, Jewish studies. And so we created Makom, first of all, to just be like transparent that we are an Orthodox organization. We're not going to just, you know, sort of sit here and pretend to, you know, just eat cholent together. Like, no, we're going to say that we are explicitly an Orthodox organization. If you would like to explore that, that's what you can do here. Footsteps starts at 18. We started at 18. We kind of peter off at around 40. What we found is that we were open to any age and the 19-year-olds did not want to be hanging out with their bobbies. And so we did cap the age. We looked into doing an older group. It never really took off. So we have about 20 years of span. We are not a mental health organization. That's something that we also had to sort of figure out as we sat down with our board and sat down with an organizational consultant. My passion isn't mental health. Being on the internet, you end up dealing with a lot of mental health issues, but that was never my passion or my training. I majored in philosophy. I love to argue, debate, you know, present ideas in a meaningful way. So we do referrals to mental health organizations. We have a PsyD on staff, but he's there to make sure that we're being sort of sensitive to mental health needs and that we're looking for red flags or anything that, you know, could be alarming. We developed a code of conduct early on to be able to explain what appropriate boundaries are and make sure that people don't get into unhealthy interactions with one another. And so what we offer at Macomb are classes on Jewish classes, social events like, you know, barbecues and hiking. We do career-based events showing people that grew up in the Black Hat world and went off to get a higher education or career. We do events around mental health and their connection to Judaism. We have
How do you promote? How do you advertise? How do you recruit people to these events?
We have an intake process. So Malcolm, at first, the first year in 2015 was just anybody coming, and there was really kind of no way to like sort of follow the journey. So instead, what we did was we created a CRM database with an intake process where we make sure that the person is coming from the background that we're looking to attract and make sure that they're sort of stable enough to be on this journey. And then we sort of track them with events and, you know, monthly follow-ups, Shabbos placement, Shabbatones. We don't place people for Shabbos right away. We want to get to know them first before we put them into someone's
house. How do they find you? How do they know you exist?
They find us through either Ketzer, through our social media. We have never done any formal recruitment because we don't see ourselves as, we don't have a recruitment goal. We're not trying to grow the number of Mako members. It's interesting. We've had OTD people who have asked if we'll help pull, you know, ultra-Orthodox Jews out of their world. And we've had ultra-Orthodox Jews ask if we'll pull OTD people out of their world. And what we say to both sides is that we are not here to recruit. We're here as a service for someone who is looking for what we have to offer. If someone is happy in the Haredi world, if someone is happy in the OTD world, Zygazunt, let them be as they are. We are a resource and a service for people that are looking essentially to make amends with their Judaism. We have one member who was part of the OTD community for quite some time. And she told me that someone was writing, which Jewish organizations have helped you? And it came up, Macomb was something that had helped someone that she knew and respected. And she said she had spent so many years being angry at Judaism and angry in her relationship to Judaism. And when she saw that comment, that she said, you know what? I'm ready now to sort of reconcile, to come to terms, to sort of go back and face the stuff that hurt me and see if I can make amends with it. We have another member who was OTD. She's observant again now. And she said she has friends who left completely and they've done the mental health work, but she feels there's not healing in the same way that she's healed, because she said just as a Black person can't stop being Black, she said a Jew can't stop being a Jew. And if you ultimately hate Jewishness and Judaism, you hate a piece of yourself. So she said through Macomb, she kind of got herself exposed again to new approaches, to davening, to learning, to Shabbos. She's changed the way she says it now. So she says God and Shabbat instead of Hashem and Shabbos, because the old way had, you know, trauma and abuse connected to it. And she's finding a new way to describe those words that now imbue positivity and meaning. In terms of what a success case is, it's really someone feeling like they have a Macomb now. I mean, it's pretty clear in the name that, you know, we want people to feel attached somewhere. And, you know, since the framework that we're putting out is Orthodox, is there an Orthodox community, friendship, social circle, school, rabbi? Is there a place in the Orthodox world that you can feel you have your Macomb? That for us would be a success story. This is a many multi-year journey to do all that healing. I think it really depends on how quickly a person is able to start separating out the two, the dysfunction that they experience versus what Judaism did to them. Now, I will say Judaism sort of given over through a lens of fear-based education, silencing questions, simplistic reading, racism, xenophobia, you know, sexism. These are really problematic ways to read Jewish sources. And so people really can, you know, imbibe a Torah that's been corrupted. And so like, those are real issues where they have to relearn things where, you know, they have to see the positivity of how mitzvahs can look. So there is a lot of sort of breaking down and building up. And that's why we have the Tikkun branch, because it's not only the, you know, family dynamics or the abuse that they, you know, experience. There are systemic issues in the challah classes, in the schools, in the shidduch system that have to be addressed, or else the problems will keep happening. What we've seen is that kids from highly functional homes can go through the system and be mostly okay. And that's why for years, as I heard from two different sides, I heard from the OTD side, you're too positive, you're crazy, you're a whitewasher, you're out to lunch. I heard from the happy Haredi side, you're a basher, you're a trasher. Why are you so negative? We have a beautiful life. Now you know why the Mishpacha article didn't bother me. I've been just being told, what do you know? You're an outsider. And so I sort of had this opportunity to step back and say, both sides feel so confident about their reality. Is it possible that both experiences are real? What makes the difference? They've gone to the same school. In some cases, they've gone to the same school. It's because in the healthy homes, they feel loved, seen, held, heard. They've been given a voice to advocate for themselves. Their parents told them when to throw a garbage idea out the window that the teacher said. That makes all the difference. And that's why we have to educate parents on how to give over these feelings and practices in the home. And it's why we also have to make sure that the schools don't do damage in the homes where the kids are getting lost and are falling through the cracks, because we will not be able to, end all dysfunction. But if we can build healthier systems in the systems, then we can hopefully try to have, just a healthier society. And that could be a segue into our Tikkun project that we're working on.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that, unless Yochevi, you want to jump in. But I want to ask you about the Tikkun, because, you talked about working behind the scenes to try to fix some of the broken parts of the system, of which I have a few questions. First of all, I admire that a lot. I think there are people who are outsiders to a system, bothered by dysfunction in a system, and then take to public campaigns to attack or change the system. And it's ineffective, because generally I find that what happens with an audience and with the light on and the cameras rolling, it's salacious, it's controversial. Certainly it attracts a lot of attention and people weigh in on both sides, but it doesn't usually garner change. The change happens when behind the scenes, people who will never write or publish about it simply sit and talk and are committed to work on things, to make some changes, to partner and collaborate. So that very premise of the work, your work in Tikkun, I admire and kol hakavod to you. I think it's the way that things happen. But do people say, Allison, you're an outsider? The community you live in, the way you brought up, and even how you identify today, which part of the Orthodox community. So it's lovely you're working. Makom is doing amazing things for those who need it. And please continue to do that. It's helpful. But sort of, who are you to try to change our system? You're an outsider to it. So how do you engage? How do you gain legitimacy? How do you gain authority as a voice? And what are the types of things that can be done to actually move the needle and make a difference instead of being a critic from the outsider who's creating sort of more cynicism about it? Because there are problems, let's be clear, there are problems in every community. Right. There are problems in the modern Orthodox community. There are problems in the open Orthodox community. There are problems in the Haredi community, Hasidic community. There are problems in every community. And ultimately, the change will happen when the leadership in those community is inspired, motivated, moved to make the changes internally. And that could come from some support or could be initiated from outside the community, but it likely is not going to happen because they saw a video or there was an event or there was something bashing and trashing them, as you said. So, and we wouldn't want that within our own community, right? We want whatever community one identifies with, you wouldn't want an outsider to it, only pointing out the bad, not the good, and inciting cynicism about it, being perceived as attacking and criticizing and condemning it. Just not the way that change happens. So how does Tikkun, you've got your list of how many things, 13 things, 15 things?
18. So Tikkun, a couple of things. So first off, I think Jew in the City got sort of the recognition and branding as people to show the beauty of the community and to promote Kiddush Hashem. So when you start to talk about making improvements under the guise of Kiddush Hashem, that comes from a place of building. And like Tikkun was never the initial idea. Spreading the beauty of Torah, how it's affected my life personally, and all that it's brought to give my life meaning and purpose and joy, is something that's very sincere and meaningful to me. So that's always sort of been the underlying message. And I think we gained that type of trust for years. Content that we put out started getting shared in more right-wing circles, under Kiddush Hashem content. If we create videos or some of our all-stars, we're always careful to have all-stars that fall under the ultra-Orthodox or Hasidic umbrella, because we want to be able to celebrate that too. I personally have a Haimish family that I've been going to since I'm 18 years old in Lakewood, New Jersey. The joy, the positivity, the fine kite that exists in this family, the friends that come over, I can look at them and see things that they do in terms of chesed, in terms of purity, that don't exist in my world. And I'm very proud of my community. So I think that while I see issues that need to be fixed, I'm also looking at a place of really being able to understand the beauty and appreciate that. And I think you can't come in as an outsider who like only sees the worst. In terms of people pushing back, I'm not making this message public. These are conversations that I'm having with leadership, you know, behind closed doors, via emails, when no one has to sort of save face. I think, you know, some of the problems of more of the activism side of handling things, and I will clarify, sometimes creating noise on the sort of media activism side does get people that are sort of sluggish on the other side to wake up. And even if I don't want to be a part of that myself, there is a certain value of like, kind of like beating the drum, kind of breaking things down. And people on the inside are like, uh-oh, now they could circle the wagons and sort of, you know, become stronger. And maybe there is also some movement too, because it gets them scared. So there may be some value in that. That's not my role. But I want to just sort of put out the fact that there could be some value, although with rising anti-Semitism, I have to say that concerns me more than ever. But when we've approached leadership, we've come from a place of, we know you're good people. We know you believe in our values. We know our values are to treat women with dignity and to see Tselem Elohim in every human being and to be, you know, Ehrlich. And so in these ways, it seems like we're not doing that. We don't want to be liars. Here we are promoting, you know, the Orthodox community to the world. We have to like be doing the things that we say that we're doing. And so it's sort of created this interesting dynamic of being the cheerleaders for the Orthodox community, kind of gave room in sort of backroom discussions to say, oh, but we're not doing that as well as we could. And so maybe we should fix that. So in terms of how we've divided this list of 18 issues, there are school issues, home issues, and combination. I think that working on a change within schools is the most way to be impactful to the most amount of people, because if you want to look at like each institution has hundreds or thousands of people. Growing up outside the community, I think it actually gives me an ability to see things with a fresh lens that someone who's always been there might not recognize as strange. And I also don't feel burned by the system. I'm not personally hurt by, you know, the system taking me down or ruining my life. Like, Orthodoxy helped my life. Orthodoxy gave my life meaning when, you know, I was searching for meaning after a childhood triple murder. So I've really seen the beauty of Torah. Something that was said to me probably about 20 years ago when I was in Israel and I met a Beis Yaakov grad, she referenced a school and she called the school like the name of the principal's school. And I thought she meant she's the head of the school. About 2 years ago, what I realized is that this person owns the school, that in a lot of black hat schools, the structure is that there is one person who owns it, runs it like a business. And if that person is wonderful, things could be okay. If that person pretends to be wonderful, but really on the side, torments students, abuses students, doesn't even actually have to break the law, may just be a manipulative, you know, humiliating, controlling type of person, that could be too much power in one person's hands. This really got started. Tikkun got started because we have a Mako member who recounted a story of a principal. It was decades later, and this member was still convulsing as she gave over to me the way that he humiliated her and controlled the women in the school. And I was so horrified. How could this be? Well, he has all the power. So I got to thinking, like, what if we could just create checks and balances and transparency and better governance in schools? If something is operating as it did in the shtetl, it's not because anyone had any bad ideas. They're just sort of doing things like they always did them. But now that we know about good governance and organizations, I had to learn this from my organization when we, you know, got seed funding. I had to learn, how do I run this in a responsible way where there's transparency and checks and balances and I report to a board and creating bylaws and having, you know, a code of conduct within Macomb. There are ways to run things with good governance. And many times organizations and schools simply don't have this because no one told them that they need to do this. Now, checks and balances is such a Jewish idea. Melech, Navi, Sanhedrin, a watchful eye and a listening ear. Transparency is also a basic idea in Jewish ethics. So the idea, and we're working now, partnering now with Debbie Fox of Magen Yaladim, who's a leading child safety expert. When I said this to her, why does this exist? It seems like the step before the child safety kit. She said, you're absolutely right. So she's been working now for months, taking a toolkit that exists for non-Jewish schools and making it now appropriate for a black hat environment. And then we're going to continue building on this, creating a task force, getting, you know, leading people with, you know, in educators, mental health professionals, rabbanim, on board. and then start with like, you know, a test community. And then from there, God willing, scale it. But the idea will be that the foundation of the school begins with Yashrus, checks and balances. Every boss has a boss. No one has too much power. Teachers and Rebbeim know what their sort of code of conduct is. Parents understand when a line has been crossed and when they can call in and where they report that to. And so hopefully it won't be a perfect system, but the more you build structure, the harder it is for shady characters to kind of weasel their way through.
I want to reiterate the reason. First of all, I think it's fantastic. And Yasher Koach, all that you do. I'm exhausted just listening to describe one of the things, let alone all the things. It's really, really tremendous. And I'm really impressed, inspired. It's amazing what you're doing. Again, I want to reiterate the reason I think it's brilliant and effective is because you're not running a public campaign to shame the broken parts of a system. You're working behind the scenes to, as somebody who says, I'm a cheerleader, I'm an advocate, I celebrate all that you have, that we are, but help me do it. Let's fix these things so I can do it better. But with that in mind, I'm wondering, does anyone ever come back to you and say, Allison, it's a lot of broken parts of your system, of your community, of your schools, of your neighborhood. Are any of the 18 things in your own community, or are they all part of another community that you're trying to fix? And does anyone say to you, Allison, how would you feel if there was a member of that other community who started an organization and met with the leadership of your community behind the scenes to fix all the things they think are wrong with your school, shul, community that's emphasizing the wrong things or practicing the wrong way or not graduating people the way they should be graduated? You know, how would you feel? Do you ever get that feedback or pushback?
I've never actually gotten that feedback before. It's interesting. This journey from Keter to Makom to Tikkun happened so organically. Really, so much of the stuff that we have to counter in media is around the Haredi world. Now, there's probably different reasons you could give for why that's happening. That's not to say that there's no dysfunction in the modern Orthodox world. There certainly is. There's certainly, you know, problematic things going on. I do think the Holocaust as a factor of sort of affecting basically 100% of the population and the insularity of the community, kind of like wrapping that all into place, increased sort of dysfunctional patterns within families, less access to mental health help. I'll tell you, in my own family, we don't have any Holocaust survivors, but my mother is the child of a pogrom survivor. So my grandfather went OTD after he survived the pogrom in Ukraine, where they lined up his family to see how many Jews a bullet could go through. And my mother was raised that every non-Jew ultimately hates a Jew. Scratch a goy, he hates a Yid. That's what my grandfather would say to my mother. My mother then said that to me and my sisters, and our best friends were not Jewish. We're like, Mommy, you're crazy. Like, our best friends are not Jewish. Because we were exposed to the larger world, we were able to filter out whatever message came from my grandfather and take it with a grain of salt and say, okay, yes, there are some Jew haters, and also there's some great people too. I think specifically the amount of people affected by the Holocaust and the closed nature of the system. In fact, we're working with some psychologists partnering with them to do a study to see, did insularity and sort of high levels of Holocaust survivors in the family increase the amount of dysfunction? Did that amplify dysfunction through different family lines if you go down generations? That's our hypothesis. If that's true, that would be a very interesting sort of response to media amplifying our stories of dysfunction. These are basically stories of Jews being hurt by Jew haters and awful patterns sort of, you know, entering families and then people trying to escape their heritage when really they have to heal themselves and see the beauty and pride in who they are and separate that out. But like, again, in terms of how Tikkun is being presented, I'm not here to get into people's faces. What I tell, you know, the Haredi leadership when I'm talking to them, it's not about like, oh, we don't want them to go OTD. We don't want them to go to Makom. We don't want them to make a Chil Hashem. We want your constituents to be happy in their world and be happy in their families and be whole and find meaning and find joy. That is something that was definitely a learning experience at Makom, because the original couple that came for help said, we want to be Jewish like you. I thought, oh, they want to stop wearing stockings and eat Chalav Stam. I didn't realize what they really were saying. We want to be healthy Jewish like you. So if someone can find their happiness, you know, within their world, but just connect to happy people and non-toxic people, you know, I think that that's a huge win. If there was someone outside the community that found ways to make things better, they had an insight because they weren't, you know, so ingrained in it and could see something to make things better, I'm all for improving. I think we should constantly be working on ways to improve.
I wonder if we should make a parallel list, an 18 things in our community, so to say, parallel list to be working and doing tikkun across the spectrum.
So look, the stuff that these different branches formed from, it started first with the media, and the media is mostly focused on the ultra-Orthodox world. And again, we could answer different reasons for that, of why they look more Jewish. The stories are more extreme when they leave. I happen to think that while there certainly is dysfunction in the modern Orthodox world, I think there's more access to mental health help, and I think there's less Holocaust trauma. So I think it is a less dysfunctional community. That's not to say that we shouldn't improve. The things that I do see in my community, you know, the Rabbanim in my community, like, shut down everything for COVID before, like, the government told us to. There was a Rebbe in my kid's school that, you know, was doing inappropriate things. A letter was sent out publicly to say that this person has been fired and should not be hired anywhere else. Like, they're doing, were these things happening 20 years ago? There were definitely some mistakes made in the modern Orthodox world, but there's a lot of learning that's been done, which I feel very proud of. Is there still more work that could be done? 1,000%. But in terms of, like, dealing with these different issues, that's not the work that came to me. That's not the issues that have come up in media. Those are not the people that have said, we hate our Judaism. Can you help us, you know, find a more positive way? And, you know, the issues that I compiled in the Tikkun list really, again, came organically out of what's causing the Chilul Hashem, what's causing people to leave. But if somebody wants to come to the modern Orthodox world and work on improving issues that exist, I'm not taking that on because I'm a little bit busy, but I would, you know, encourage anyone who wants to And to be a Jew means to be doing a cheshbon hanefesh, to be constantly self-reflecting. That's, we should be proud. I would say that tikkun itself is a kiddush Hashem. When I'm talking to the other Hollywood bureaus, some of them have commented to me, we love that you're not just doing advocacy. We love that part of your work of making your community, you know, more respected and less hated is also taking a look within. What a wonderful thing to say that we're a self-reflective group and that we can always grow and improve.
And it's our community. The truth is the work is because we're all one. So the way you're saying is the way it's depicted is not fixing someone else's community. We're all Torah, one community. And the more we all improve and the more we all have a better face and the more functional we all are, the better we all are together.
I think that when I look at you and I hear about all this, as someone who has a lot of comments and opinions about what's going on across the spectrum, we're all one big firm world. I don't like to differentiate. I think that, you know, this is where you fell in and this is where you're focusing, but, you know, I'm sure there are muck homes for every community within Orthodoxy, and there needs to be, and issues all over. But I certainly have my opinions, and I'll get upset about this system and upset about that. And I think that what amazes me about you and women like you, from a woman, is just the idea that you had these issues and you had these problems and you took a stand and you made a difference and you're constantly making a difference. What would be your advice to other women, I guess for men too, who have all these opinions and feelings? What's the next step? How do you get to that point where you could really step up, stand out, make a difference for all of us who feel those ways? What could we do?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think we live in a society where to have your face somewhere or to be seen is like the highest level of making it. And sort of what the content behind that is doesn't really matter. So I like not irregularly hear people talking about, I'm going to start a podcast. What should it be about? But I'm like, nothing. Don't do one. Why? Because have a message first, have passion first, and then figure out how you're going to deliver it. But the idea of, and look, I grew up in the secular world. So while I was having very dark, like existential fears about, you know, maybe I won't exist one day and maybe you just decompose, I was also having super shallow ideas of like, I have a presence, I should be on a stage somewhere. And that was sort of this dichotomous side of myself that I had sort of believed that myth that to be seen and heard is to matter in the secular world. The truth is that the highest level of greatness is to actually behind the scenes. Hashem is hidden and we're hidden. And that's something I like to talk about frequently. I do have a public face here, but I recognize that the ego loves glory and being seen. And it takes away from some of the good work by being out there so much. I think it's a duty because I do have this passion. And in terms of how to take that passion and do something with it, what I would say is the first thing you have to do is get over the idea of why me. Because that, you didn't ask me that question, Rabbi Goldberg, that could have been a very good question. Why you? Who are you to be the face of Orthodoxy? Who are you to deal with the, you know, OTD issue? Who are you to, a little bit for the tikkun thing? It's really because, like, we look at the Maccabees, we look at Nachshon Ben Aminadab. We have a tradition where people that weren't necessarily specifically equipped to do these things just got up and did them. And I think that that's, you know, one of the most powerful ideas, Nasa Venishma. We'll get started in the work and we'll figure it out as we go along. That's one of the most powerful things that has kept me going. You have to, first of all, be ready for a lot of rejection, a lot of people telling you that it's not you, it shouldn't be you. What are you doing? How do you know? And just continue working on it. Because I think what I did, I would say for me, that helped me get from just sort of being passionate and a lady making crazy videos on her couch back in early days of Jew in the City to now being a nonprofit leader, which my kids are so thrilled about because now they can say my mother leads a nonprofit. Before, they were like, what does your mother do for a living? Oh, she's a Jew in the City. That was a really confusing thing I have to say. I got an organizational coach. I took a nonprofit course. I learned how to give over mission, programs, metrics, cost, output. I was able to organize with the help of experts what we do, how we do it, making sure that our different branches are all coming back to that initial mission of reversing negative associations of Orthodox Jews and showing that, you know, Orthodox Judaism can be engaging and beautiful. But what I would say is, if there is a passion, get started. I heard of a beautiful idea from a winner on Shark Tank, Jenny Himmelfarb, I think her name is Goldfarb. She said that the word mazel comes from makom, is the mem, place. Zman, time, you have to be in the right place in the right time, but you have to have the lamed part, lasot, you have to be doing. So there will be moments that, you know, there's hashgacha, that things are bashert and they all come together. And certainly I daven for the right wisdom, the right creativity, the right funding, the right partnerships to keep moving this forward. But the main thing is that you have to be doing if you're going to catch that place in that time.
So what the people who are watching right now who are sold on what you're doing and really feel passionately about it, is there anything we could do on our own? I mean, we live here. I think you're probably based more in the New York area. But, you know, what can we do to help your projects, to help your messaging, to help all that you're doing to support it?
Can I compliment that question? Because I would make it, you know, funding is an obvious one, obviously supporting the mission and funding. And it's the answer for you. Many of our guests, obviously it's a worthwhile cause. You wouldn't be on, we wouldn't be in this conversation. We wouldn't have a relationship and know you. But beyond that, in terms of more broader, the mission, right? So go back to Keter and Orthodox All-Stars. Everyone could be an All-Star if at work and in life, they're promoting and representing and sharing, and with anti-Semitism on the rise, we're more responsible. So maybe if you could answer Yechaveh's great question in that direction, is not just what people can do, although you're welcome to share it to help fund and support the work you're doing, but how can they become partners in the work you're doing and themselves ambassadors of that work?
That was my question. 100%.
Yeah. So in terms of being ambassadors, pretty much any question that could come up in work of anything your coworker might think is weird or might have seen in the news or on TV, we've probably answered. So like, feel free to use over at jewinthecity.com, our search engine, to deal with different, like, you know, rituals or holidays or newsy type of things to be able to have information behind it. And then yes, every moment that we're engaging with people outside of our community, and sometimes even people within our community, can be an opportunity. Our sort of founding principles are menschlichkeit, ehrlichkeit, and seichel. When Judaism has kindness, tolerance, sincerity, critical thinking, when it has those values in it, Judaism can be a wonderful thing. Observant life can be a wonderful thing. So first of all, embody those values yourself, and then shine those ideas to the world. Be willing to listen. Be willing to engage, be willing to separate out, you know, dysfunctional cases or abusive cases from what our values actually are, and actually like embody Kiddush Hashem, because being the Jew that someone knows, the Orthodox Jew that someone knows, who is generous, who is kind, who is flexible, who is courageous, that is so powerful. That's more powerful than any piece of content that we could put out to have that personal connection. On the Makom side, we are always looking for Makom hosts, you know, from homes that are, you know, full of love and open-mindedness and can really just take someone in to take them as they are and to just kind of be a second family for them. That's the type of host that we're looking for Makom. And then on the fundraising piece, not just donations, but we have a program called Changemakers. It's a monthly donation, whatever you can afford, to just kind of be with us as we dare to dream these big and crazy things. I'll say it again. Like, it didn't have to be me. It's just that, like, I decided it was going to be me. And as the problems, I think I'm done with the branches now. I think three branches is really all I can handle. Four kids, three branches. But it's really just sort of like seeing the issue and having some vision about how to do it. But yes, if you come and support us with a one-time donation by becoming a change maker, we feel that partnership of you, you know, daring to dream big dreams with us and really showing the world the beauty that is our heritage, because it has been trounced on and trampled on for too long by outsiders, by ourselves, so much self-hatred. And it's time that we change that. And I feel like just as Hollywood was started by Jews running from their identity, hiding as we do, we see the message now that we're, you know, working on is lean in harder, come out prouder, cling to our people, to be unified and connected to our tradition more than ever.
You're doing amazing things, Allison. Thank you for all that you're doing. Keep fighting the fight. Keep making the change. Keep being that source of light. And there are a million things we didn't get to, which is your own story and your own background. And so many other questions, how you balance it all and how you find the time and how your family deals with your being a public person. There are a million more questions, which just means we'll have to continue the conversation another time. But thank you for joining us and really keep doing all that great work.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on.
Rabbi Brody.
She is passionate. A lot of good stuff going on there, huh?
She's passionate. She's doing a lot of good work, a lot of great things, and appreciative of it. She is a change maker.
Yeah.
You know, her article and some of the things that she referenced definitely was a little bit of a lightning rod, garnered a lot of attention, mixed attention. You know, people even give me feedback once we promoted we're having her on, because she stimulated a lot of conversation, and that generates a lot of people to think. So this article about the off the derech, or why the people who are searching for themselves, what were they lacking in their own childhood? It got a lot of people thinking, and there probably is something to the thesis that she has. She has a lot more interaction than I do. I would just say that maybe what she's suggesting is a sampling, not everybody. And I think it's really important to qualify. I know people, there are people that I love very much. There are people I'm very close to. There are members of family who have children off the derech. And these parents couldn't be more loving, couldn't give more space, couldn't be more supportive. Right. And I just think, as much as we may see trends, as much as we might have a hypothesis or a thesis of what we could do differently and how we could learn and grow, it's really important to acknowledge you could have the perfect parents in the ideal home. And what will happen to the child, you know, people have bechira, they have free will, they have choice, and you never know. So we can do both. We can look to see trends and to extract lessons, but we can at the same time be really careful to ensure that there's some nuance and subtlety, and that not everybody is experiencing the same thing or came at it for the same reason. And that even if people are perfect, you never know. And you see within one home, some children are really into it. Others are less into it. It's a complicated topic. And I think it needs that complexity and the acknowledgement that it's not one size fits all. But it generated a lot of conversation, which I think is on the whole a good thing. You know, people agree or disagree, and the letters in Mishpacha continue. I don't know if it's going to keep going on this week. When I wrote the article about Shidduchim, my buddies at Mishpacha would tell me every week that the feedback and the letters, the ongoing conversation, had set the record for how long after the original article. It might have been surpassed now with this.
They just broke the record.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was, because it got a lot of emotion and a lot of attention. The other thing I would say is I'm not sure that the whole Haredi world are descendants from Holocaust survivors. I think that in the more yeshivish Hasidic world, there certainly are coming from a lot of areas where there were more Holocaust survivors, and that might be. It could be a lot more prevalent to descend from the Holocaust, but I don't think you could say everybody there was. And I think outside of the right-wing world, there's a lot of second generation, third generation Holocaust.
We know many of them.
I think that one needs nuance too. But Allison is really, she's a go-getter, a self-starter. She's initiated this project. She's a pioneer when she was making these videos and representing and promoting Orthodoxy, Torah, all stars, good things. And, you know, in the end of the day, if you're at the front lines and you're working hard and you're trying to make a difference, you'll make a difference. And I think that deserves our acknowledgement and support.
Absolutely.
But you're also going to ruffle some feathers, and that's just the way it is.
I just think that in the world that we live in, there we should never underestimate the power of a good Rebbe. You know, a bad Rebbe could really turn you off, but a great Rebbe can really just keep you going. It just keeps you excited, keeps you motivated, keeps you focused.
Yeah.
And you know,
which is why it's complex, because you could have amazing parents and have had a terrible abusive Rebbe. You could have the most amazing Rebbe, but your parents didn't give you the love that you were looking for.
Right.
You know, it's tough. We had a program last night, and I want to tell everybody watching and listening right now live, or if you're listening later, you got to watch this, and I guarantee you will not regret giving it the time. We're going to actually publish the audio of it as a bonus episode of Behind the Bima, maybe of Out of the Shadows. Also, the Foreman family, Alana Foreman, who's a recovering addict, for the very first time, sat on a panel with her parents, amazing people, and her brother, a member of the Kollel at Yeshiva South Florida. And you had a recovering addict, her parents, and her brother on a panel first time together. They've spoken publicly. I don't think Gavriel has. Gavi has, but they together. And we had an over hour conversation last night. It was an event at the shul, but it was recorded and you could watch it on our YouTube channel. Like I said, we'll publish the audio. And she walked through her whole, what led to it, when she start, what'd she do, had she experienced it, recovery, her perspective, the parents, what they went through, how they navigated, not necessarily being on the same page, how it got between them and ultimately led them closer. Her brother, how his job was to be neglected, knowing parents are putting all their energy, time, resources into the sister. He was an adult way too soon and raising his other siblings because the parents weren't there. It was unbelievable conversation. But I asked a question. I asked a question at the end because in advance they had said kind of like, put it all out there, open it up, put it on the table. If we don't answer, we won't. And they didn't know what each other was going to say because first time together in a panel live. Anyway, but I asked Alana, I said, because she told the story, it was the night before she started high school. She had a lot of anxiety and fear, a lot of worry, concern, insecurity. She had seen on TV, movies, read in books, what alcohol can do. And she figured, parents aren't home. Let me go to the alcohol cabinet and let me try alcohol because that'll just take off the nerves, take off the edge so I could start high school tomorrow without fear. And I won't give the rest away, but that started her story. So I asked her, I said, let me ask you, if there were no alcohol cabinet in your home, no schnapps, right. It was locked, you couldn't get to it. Would you not be here tonight? Would you not be a recovering addict because you never would have started down this road? Or would it have been something else? And it was a fascinating question. Answer. She gave an amazing answer. But I think part of the answer, and I'm leaving it as a teaser so you watch or listen to it because there really is a lot to listen to. But what I also took away from it was, you know, I'll give you a little bit. She did say like, it wasn't one thing. And it wasn't my parents did. And it wasn't, she said, I was trying to fill a void. I was trying to numb myself to something. Something was wrong in me. And if it weren't the alcohol, I would have found something else. I would have filled that hole with something else. I would have tried to fix it with something else. Happened to be the alcohol because that was what was available. If it weren't, it would have been something else. And she said, you know, my parents, nothing. It was nothing to my parents, you know? So
it's amazing.
It's not simple. Complex. Whether it's addiction or off the derech, there are trends and there are themes. And there are things that we can learn. And I'm not saying Allison's wrong. I don't work in that space. I don't know. I'm not saying she's wrong. I'm just saying, I think, you know, I know it's important because it's also, we offer theses and we write articles. I'm guilty of this. I've experienced this and I feel bad and guilty for this. I've apologized for this. You write an article, you express a thesis, you make a statement, and you can forget sometimes there's like real people on the other end who read it that you're talking about or that you're making suggestions, conjectures about. And, you know, if you sat across from them and said it, you might give it another context. You might qualify it. You might say it more sensitively. I've been guilty myself. I've tried to learn from it as people have given that feedback to it. So complicated issue, but look, she's at the front lines and she's doing good work. So she certainly, I think, is entitled to a voice in the conversation.
It's amazing. Well,
what's on the horizon for you, Rabbi Brody?
Well, I'll be signing autographs this Sunday at the Kinos Shluchim. I will first time ever. Wow. And I'm excited. It actually won't be so hard to find me. Just look for the one guy without a hat. Probably
that's not true, by the way. There's a ton of people, including members of our community. Every year, I say, this is the year I'm going to go. Yeah. I desperately want to go. Have a beautiful bar mitzvah this Sunday. Your wife is helping to actually put together. And a bar mitzvah.
I just found a sponsor for the caper.
Yeah, beautiful bar mitzvah, and I'm not going to miss it. So I will be there. You'll have to give me the report on the Kinnis HaShluchim.
I will. It's a
high energy, amazing event.
Oh, I can't wait. I'm actually really, really pumped. And let me tell you something. After Shacharis this past Monday, I said, you know, I'm ready to go back to Boca. Like I don't even need the next 3 days here. I just, you know, you go in and you're in that environment. It just pumps you right up. So
it's great. We got the Shabbos Joe Gittler, former Behind the Bima guest. Joe Gittler, founder of Leket. Talk about game changer. People who see a problem, an issue, they don't sit back. They step up and they try to solve it. And Joe definitely is on the list, towards the top of the list. So we're excited. Joe's going to be here this Shabbos. My dear friend Rabbi Avi Schneider will be here this Shabbos, giving the Chabura, coming in tonight. So excited to have him. There's great stuff going on all around. Great conversation. A lot of food for thought. So thank you for joining us. And thank you to our dear friends, the Rudenskis, for your sponsorship, for your support. Check it out. Watch or listen to that conversation with the Foreman family about addiction. It's really, really, really worthwhile. And we got more great stuff coming up. But until next time. Stay happy, stay healthy, and stay holy.
Thank you for listening to Behind the Bima. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next week for another peek behind the Bima.